First Kings. We come now to the middle of Solomon's reign, and we have a second appearance as God comes to Solomon and speaks to him. Ask anything. Solomon asked for wisdom. God gave it to him in abundance, and because Solomon asked for wisdom instead of treasures and power and all the things that kings normally seek after, God gave Solomon a great kingdom, the greatest kingdom. And here we have, after the building of the temple, after the building of Solomon's own palace, so roughly 20 years in, somewhere in that range. It's not exact, but somewhere in the range of the middle of Solomon's reign, God comes to Solomon in verse 3. It says, "And the Lord said to him, 'I have heard your prayer and your supplications that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to my name, to put my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now if you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons at all turn from following me, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them. And this house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all people. And as for this house which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? Then they will answer, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and have embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this calamity on them." So we have here a severe warning with an incredible promise. God comes to Solomon and he first reaffirms the Davidic covenant that if Solomon will obey, then his throne will be established forever. And if Solomon's sons will continue to obey, the kingdom will be established. That you will have this incredible, glorious kingdom in Israel. And I want to remind you that we go back even to the book of Exodus, and we see God delivering Israel out of Egypt and bringing them and then establishing them in the land of Canaan in Joshua and Judges. We see that God is doing all of this to show the world that he is God. He is making some very clear displays that he alone is God. Now as we saw last week talking about the temple, it is there at the temple in Jerusalem that the presence of God dwelt. It was only in the temple at Jerusalem that the presence of God dwelt. And the temple was to be a house of prayer. Yeah, and not just Israel, but all the nations. So that Solomon, in his dedicatory prayer, specifically says, when the people of the world see the glory of this house, and they come and pray there, he asks God to hear their prayers. And so God is established Israel and now Solomon and Solomon's temple to show the entire world that he is God. And so this Davidic covenant that is now extended to Solomon and specifically given to Solomon continues that purpose of showing the world that the God of Israel is the only true God. But what happens when Israel disobeys? But it is a calamity that shows the world that the God of Israel is God. It's not just a matter of they stopped worshiping God and went to worship other gods and they continued on. That God says, I am going to do these things. I will cut off Israel from the land which I've given them. And they will be a proverb and a byword. So that people will come by and will remember the former glory of Solomon's temple. They will see Jerusalem in rubble, the temple cast down, and say, why has this happened? Because they abandoned God. They turned their back on Him. They disobeyed Him and worshiped false gods. And so that, and we can take that just as a quick aside. We can talk about that still today. We have this testimony in Israel that God is God, that there are consequences of disobeying God, so that we now have a Temple Mount that has an Islamic temple on it. There's now a wailing wall. There's not it is a retaining wall, but it's not this former glory of what was in Herod's temple. It is ruins. Why? Because Israel rejected their God. And we can leap from here to Jesus' own words saying, cast down, this temple will be cast down. Not one stone will be left on top of another. It's going to be utterly destroyed. And it is. It's been cast down. So again, there's nothing left but a retaining wall. Because God is still God. And so there's this incredible display and this incredible warning in this point of this display. I'm not going to go through all of chapter 10, but it is intriguing, to say the least, to read of the immense wealth of Solomon. Not only was he the wisest of the kings of the earth, he was the richest of the kings of the earth. It says in chapter 10 that all of Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. And silver was so abundant it was worthless. They didn't care about silver. It was, chump change. That's how much Solomon had. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1. And we don't know exactly when this is. It's definitely the second half of Solomon's reign. It says when he is old. So it may have been the last 5-10 years of Solomon's life. We don't know exactly, but somewhere obviously late in his reign. It says, but King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. So he had married one of Pharaoh's daughters. He also loved women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. Now don't read verse 2. Now everybody's reading verse 2. What's the problem with that? I mean, besides having a whole bunch of wives, what's the problem with what Solomon is doing? God had very specifically commanded Israel to not intermarry with the people of the land. It specifically includes the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Hittites. They were forbidden. So verse 2, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their God. So why did God forbid marriage to the Canaanite peoples? Exactly. The intermarriage there would cause them to worship idols. It would draw them into what God, the violation of the first and second commandments. The violation of what Jesus calls the greatest commandment. It would cause them to lead to idolatry, which is exactly what happens with Solomon. It says in verse 3, he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For so it was, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. He establishes Jerusalem as the proper center for the worship of God, the only God. He ends his reign filling Jerusalem with temples to idols. So that he's building, we don't know how many, sounds like dozens to me. He has 700 wives, and they're not, obviously they weren't all from different nations, but there would have been a wide range of gods represented among them. Molech was designed specifically so that they would burn, as Ruth said, they would burn their young children alive in this altar to Molech. Utterly abominable. The worship of Ashtaroth was abominable in a different way. It was a sexually perverse worship. So that Israel in Jerusalem is not just filled with temples, but it is... The only logical conclusion, and we can't say it definitely from this passage, but it seems very likely that the typical practices of worship to these false gods were also employed. So that Israel became a place of idolatry. Jerusalem became a place of worship to these abominable gods. Yeah, we have in this another stern reminder of the dangers of idolatry. And this is a theme that one of these years I am going to get around to really developing in a series of lessons or sermons as I need to. But it is a theme in the Old Testament particularly that runs into the New. It shows us that this idol worship, it continues today. And with or without the statues, I didn't know anything about the statue of Baal there, but with or without them, we run to idolatry. We tend to worship everything else but God. And the dangers of it are extreme. And there's, yeah, I won't go any further. I'll end up not teaching today's Sunday school lesson to teach an entirely different one. But if you want something to really study, you say, I want a big study project, idolatry. Study idolatry as it's developed in the Bible. And you'll be amazed, actually, at the implications to your life today. But let me keep moving. And so, verse 11. Because Solomon did all of these things, the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days. For the sake of your father David, I will take it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So God tells him again at the end of Solomon's life, your kingdom is gone. For David's sake, you'll keep it. But I'm going to take away your kingdom and I'm going to give it to a servant. Not a son. It's going to a servant in the house. But for the sake of David, for the sake of Jerusalem, the place where God had chosen to make his name dwell, he will preserve a portion of that kingdom in Solomon's reign, or Solomon's line. And so we go now to chapter 11, verse 26. Chapter 11 begins to speak of enemies that rise up against Solomon. And we see a guy named Jeroboam. He said, then Solomon's servant, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite from Zereda, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. And I'm not going to go through all of this, but just to summarize it, we see this Jeroboam was a servant, was an industrious man, and so Solomon gave him a position of authority and made him a leader, an overseer. And as Jeroboam was going about his work, he was met by a prophet of God who told him that God was going to take 10 of the tribes away from Solomon's house and was going to make Jeroboam king over 10 of the tribes of Israel. And so that began to be, that we see verse 40, Solomon therefore sought to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt to Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So there now there's this open conflict. Jeroboam flees the country until Solomon dies. Solomon reigned, it tells us at the end of chapter 11, for 40 years. Then after his death, his son became king. What was the name of Solomon's son? Rehoboam. So this, in my opinion, this is where the chronology of Israel and the kings of Israel becomes confusing. I don't have any problem Saul, David, Solomon. We get to Rehoboam, and we're going to talk about Jeroboam, and then we start adding in these names, and we get Abijah, and Ahijah, and Uzzah, and Azariah, and Jeroboam, and we have Zechariah and Zedekiah. We have Joash and Jehoiash, and Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin. So, if you keep all those things straight in your mind, you're doing great, I think. Because I can't keep them straight in my mind, no matter what I try. I do keep them on my mind. Yeah, I can remember some of the names. I just can't tell you who they were or where they go, except for somewhere in Israel and Judah. So, and part of what's going to happen from here in the flow of 1 and 2 Kings is now we have the interweaving together of the accounts of the kings of Judah and the kings of the 10 northern tribes. So we're about to see the split in the kingdom. The 10 northern tribes become known by what name? Israel. Those are the ones that rebel against the household of David and are taken away from Solomon's son. The kingdom that continues under the Davidic dynasty is the kingdom of Judah, which is essentially the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And Levites are scattered among both kingdoms. And so you have the 10 tribes in rebellion, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. This not precise, just so you know, there certainly tells us here that there are some of those from the tribes of the northern kingdom that remained faithful to Judah. So it's more or less accurate, but you can't say that there was nobody from the tribe of Gad in the kingdom of Judah. There's some that remain faithful, but generally speaking, the majority of the tribe of Judah stayed faithful to Solomon and Solomon's son. The majorities of the tribe of Asher, for example, rebelled. And so that's what we have. And we get to First Kings, and from here up to, I believe it's 2 Kings 17, now the story is kind of bouncing back and forth, but it's moving forward chronologically. So you have the story of a king, and then when he dies, it goes to the story of the other king. So it's going to start here with Rehoboam, and then it's going to tell us about Jeroboam. It's actually going to tell all of Jeroboam's kingdom, kingship. And when he dies, it goes back and talks about Rehoboam. And when he dies, it talks about his son. And when he dies, it goes and talks about the king of the northern kingdom. And so they kind of goes back and forth a little bit like that. And then, of course, it's talking about their interactions together. So I say all that to say it takes a little bit of attention to at least, again, for me, it takes a little bit of attention to follow which kingdom we're talking about, where we are in the timeline, but it clearly moves from first king to last king. And so there's definitely that, it's sequential. It never goes backwards in time and forwards in time, but just simply moving back and forth between the northern kingdom, southern kingdom, northern kingdom, southern kingdom, basically. So hopefully that makes everything incredibly unclear for you, so that you'll now be able to. So 1 Kings chapter 12, we see now the folly of Rehoboam. It says in verse 1, and Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and had been dwelling in Egypt, that they sent and called him. Then Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke, which he put on us, and we will serve you. So basically they're saying, Solomon taxed us heavily, and he made us work hard for him. And if you that are familiar with governments of the world, asking them to reduce taxation never works. But that's basically the request. I mean, in real short, simple terms, that's what they're saying. Your father put a great weight on us, so lessen that weight, and we will serve you faithfully. Rehoboam says, give me 3 days. Let me seek counsel on this and come back in 3 days and I'll give you an answer. So verse 6, then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before Solomon, Father Solomon, while he still lived. And he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? And they spoke to him saying, if you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. So summarize the counsel given to Rehoboam by the elders. You be good to them. You know, speak good words to them. Ease the burden some. Grant some of their requests. They'll serve you. They'll serve you faithfully. And Rehoboam didn't like that advice. Now, in my opinion, Rehoboam already had the answer. He already knew what he wanted to do. He was just looking for counselors to give him the answer he wanted. But he rejected it, verse 8, and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. And he said to them, what advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put on us? Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you should speak to your people who have spoken to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. And now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges. So what was the counsel of the young men? Let them know. Tell them who's king. Make sure they know who's boss. You press on them your authority and make sure that they know. If they thought Solomon's yoke was heavy, yeah, they're going to find out that yours is far heavier. So that, I mean, the picture there of his little finger is going to be heavier on them, or thicker and stronger. It's going to be a greater burden on them than all of Solomon was. Solomon, he may have scourged them with just regular whips in driving them to work, but Rehoboam was going to use essentially a cat of nine tails kind of thing, a scourge, a whip with many ends, a much more vicious whip. He was going to be a harsh ruler, and they better listen to him. So the response to this is what you would expect, especially given what we already know, is Israel said in verse 16, the people answered the king saying, what share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, now see to your own house, O David. So they say, fine. We're going to, you sons of David, you want to rule? You'll rule the house of Jesse, or Judah, I mean. You rule the tribe of Judah. The rest of us, we're going back home. We're going to find our own king. It says then, verse 18, King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was in charge of the revenue, but all Israel stoned him with stones and he died. Therefore, King Rehoboam mounted his chariot in haste to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. In verse 20, now it came to pass when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had come back, they sent for him and called him to the congregation and made him king over all Israel. There was none who followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only. And it now begins a civil war in which you have the house of Judah and the house of Benjamin. You see that in verse 21, are joining together in battle, ready to join in battle against the tribes of Israel. God sends a prophet to Rehoboam and says, stop. Don't go into battle because I have done this. This thing is from me. Do not go into battle against Israel. And so Rehoboam actually listens and does not go into war, open war against Israel. And so now we have the kingdom split. Rehoboam is the king in the south and Jeroboam the king in the north. Yeah, so 1 Kings chapter 12, we get to verse 25, and just for time's sake, I'm going to let you summarize this. Jeroboam looks at his kingdom and says, you know, if everybody keeps having to go to Jerusalem to worship God, that's not really going to be healthy for the stability and the independence of my nation. He makes two golden calves. He puts one in the northern part of the kingdom, one in the southern part of the kingdom, and then he tells them, here's your gods which brought you out of Egypt. Jeroboam's taking a page out of Aaron's book and going all the way back in and saying, look, the golden calves. Remember your fathers worshipped them at Mount Sinai. And he didn't tell about the rest of it. Just see, these are the gods that brought you out of Egypt. And so because of that, you got it given to Jeroboam the kingdom. But because of Jeroboam's idolatry in setting up now these false places of worship and these idols. And personally, I think the calves are not idols to any of the gods. It's not an idol to Baal. I'm of the opinion that the calves, at least in the beginning, are idols to Jehovah. These are idols to God. And yet, Jeroboam is establishing a false place of worship and he's establishing these idols, these violations of the second commandment of making an image of God. And so, because of that, he falls under judgment. And in verse chapter 13, a man of God comes to Jeroboam and tells him essentially that you're going to be under judgment. You are under the judgment of God, and you will continue to be under the judgment of God because of your idolatry. I want to mention this story here, this man of God. I know that it may be one you're familiar with already, but this prophet that goes to Jeroboam warns him, God has told him, do not stop anywhere. Go to Jeroboam, give him the warning, and do not stop anywhere. Don't go to anybody's house. Come straight back. And so when he gives the warning to Jeroboam, he is invited to stay. The king says, plead the Lord that the Lord will restore me, that his hand will not be against me. And he says, stay here, I'll reward you and give you blessings. The man of God says, no, I'm leaving. God told me not to stay, I'm not staying. He leaves, and he is met by another man of God. And it's an interesting situation now, because the first prophet goes to Jeroboam and says, tells him what God says. He knows the clear instructions from God. He has to go back home. And that's it. This other prophet of God comes to him and says, God told me to tell you to spend the night at my house. And tells us in the text he was lying. And no idea what motivated this second guy to do this. I mean, really, it's just, Scripture doesn't tell us all the ins and outs there. So, but the second prophet tells the first prophet, God told me to tell you to spend the night in my house. And so the first prophet does. And he dies. God judges him because he disobeyed the command of God. In fact, the second prophet says that he died because he disobeyed God's command. And so there's a lot of stuff in the background that we don't know. Just a lot of unanswered questions that we're going to have with this. And there's a point here of saying, why is it here? Why, I mean, this is a weird story, honestly. Why is it here? And part of the point, at least I think, part of the point is showing when there are consequences when you disobey God. That we have this quick little object lesson. It's kind of a bit of an overblown object lesson, but this quick little story that says, see what happens when you disobey God? See what Israel, look, are you paying attention? See what happens when you disobey God. And I think there's a second part of this. I've been trying to figure out the best way to say it. I still haven't figured it out. But simply that God doesn't change his commandments just willy-nilly. Jeroboam decides to set up these idols to God in Israel. Now, Jeroboam had been given the kingdom by God. God protected Jeroboam in the establishment of this kingdom. But God had not changed his mind about worshiping him and where to worship him and how to worship him. And I think that's what we see, again, in this object lesson of these two prophets, is the second prophet comes to the first prophet, and the first prophet should have known God is not going to give one command and then come back later and say, you know what? I'm going to completely contradict that command and give you something entirely different. He should have known God's commands remain the same. Now, I'm careful with that because we also, you may be thinking, well, wait a second. Then, if God never doesn't change his commands, why don't we keep all the Mosaic law? That's maybe something that pops in your mind. Why did we still eat shellfish, for example, or bacon? We're going to have ham and pintos and bacon for lunch today. So are we now violating God's commands? No, we understand with that God did not change his commands. He fulfilled them in Christ. And there's and big can of worms. I know I just opened up with that. But simply that we recognize that, you know, that principle I gave, we have to be careful in transferring the Old Testament to the New Testament. But at the same time, and especially in Israel, God wasn't just changing his mind on stuff. God's commands were the same. And that Jeroboam, no matter what seemed politically expedient, had no right to do something other than what God commanded. Even if it seemed to be from God. And so that is mostly my opinion on the prophet, those two prophets in that story there. But and in my opinion, that explains better than anything else I've come up with why that story is in there. The chapter 14, and I'm going to have to pick up with this next week, we see the judgment on Israel. It tells us that the Lord says he's going to strike Israel, he's going to scatter them, destroy them because they disobeyed. We have, again, the warning to all Israel and all Judah to obey God. The severe consequences of disobedience. That's part of what's going on, particularly in 1 and 2 Kings, is God is showing you are a covenant people. And part of this covenant is the obligation of obedience. And if you disobey, then the curses of the covenant will come upon you. We also see, as I've said so many times going through this, that the utter failure of a king to establish a righteous nation. So that you have David in his moral excellence does not establish an eternally righteous kingdom. Solomon, in his fiscal excellence, does not establish a permanently righteous kingdom. We see that they are able in all of their ability as kings to be perfectly righteous kings who are able to establish a righteous Jewish kingdom. We see woven through this the unavoidable and undeniable thread that Israel still needs a king. They still need a king who can help them keep this covenant. Because without that king, they're doomed to failure. And because we know the rest of the story, we know the name of that king. We know that he has not yet established that kingdom, but that he is going to. And there is absolutely this prophetic ribbon woven into these stories that points us to Jesus.